TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Technology and Globalization. From biotechnology to nanotechnology. From laboratory rats to atoms. Arpad Pushtai and Pat Roy Mooney. When the highly respected scientist Dr. Arpad Pushtai was asked to come out of retirement to lead a study of genetically engineered potatoes, he fully expected to prove their safety. However, during the three-year project at the Rowett Research Institute in Scotland, he became so alarmed at the impact on laboratory rats that he asked for and received permission from the institute to make a public statement. When he warned that the wide, untested release of genetically modified foods might put the public in danger, Dr. Pushtai was suspended from his work on the experiments, his computers were sealed, and his data were confiscated. He was ostracized by his colleagues and forbidden to discuss his work. A year later, in 1999, the prestigious scientific journal The Lancet published his findings. The magazine then found itself at the center of protests. Arpad Pushtai now speaks publicly on the dangers of genetic engineering of food plants. Here's his talk at the Teach-In on Technology and Globalization at Hunter College, New York, in early 2001. Dr. Arpad Pushtai.
What were the main points what we found? What we found was simply that some of the lines of genetically modified potatoes, which were for all intents and purposes looked like potatoes, they tasted like potatoes, but they did not support the growth of young animals the same way as the normal genetically untransformed potatoes did. So there was straight away a real problem that compositionally they were different. When we fed them to animals, they reacted differently. And these differences could be very serious. They at least ought to have been followed up. And all those genetically modified foodstuffs, which we are already eating, which have not been tested by this a similar method, should now be withdrawn from the market and should be investigated in as much detail as our own genetically modified potatoes were. Now, one of the findings we had was we always worked, this is a nutritional laboratory practice, we always work with male rats for nutritional testing. Don't ask me why, this is how it is done. Now, one of the problems which we found was that the male sexual organs were, in most instances, in all our four experiments, were affected. Now, we don't know what the meaning of that is, but they were affected. We don't know whether they worked better or not so well, but they were different. Now, we have never done any testing with female rats. So when we were finding these results, the first thing occurred to us that the work will have to be very urgently redone with female rats. And then if they are similarly affected, we ought to get started on reproduction studies. You see, if you have any problems along this line, and let's assume that it applies to the human population, any problems will only be discovered in 20, 30 years' time. So what will you say to your children and grandchildren if there is any problem? Why did it not happen? Why this wasn't done at the time? So that is a very important consideration. You have to think about it. Now, this is on a if it is multiplied on a global scale, we really have a problem. Now, the global implications of the GM food are very, very serious because, as you well know, 30% of the world's seed supplies is owned by 10 multinational corporations. Now, when you consider also that there are a number of strategically important patents which are owned by corporations like Monsanto, give them a stranglehold on the whole business. It's not that the fact that people have a choice. They don't have a choice because there will be more and more of the genetically modified seed varieties. Now, when you go consider a Bolgard cotton, soybean, glyphosate herbicide patent covering corn, wheat, rice, soybean, cotton, sugar beet, rapeseed, flax, sunflower, potato, tobacco, alfalfa, and so it goes on. Recombinant bovine growth hormone. You have it here in the United States. We have a war with the United States over recombinant bovine growth hormone in Europe. Now, in view of all this, we ought to be concerned about the methods of the GM biotechnology industry. What are their aims? Now, Monsanto stated some time ago that their major aim is to find solutions to the growing global needs for food and health. However, the real aim is, when you consider all what they own, all the patents they own, this is their real aim is to use the law, science, and all means of propaganda to legitimize GM food as their solution these solutions for which they are trying to find ways. And this main aim is promoted through the U.S. government policies, federal, state, international laws, politicians, civil servants, IPR, regulatory loopholes, WTO, USDA, APHIS, FDA, EPA, etc. So this is the real aim. That's how they're doing it. And they are concentrating on the patents which will give them this stranglehold. The effects of GM biotechnology is at the moment because there is virtually no testing. There's no testing. You are being used as guinea pigs, just like as I said in that 150 seconds. The effects of GM biotechnology-driven globalization mean that there is untested and potentially hazardous GM crops are spreading all over the world. This is what it means, globalization. That it will be spreading to India, it will be spreading to Africa, it will not be confined to one country where it is produced. And this will create irreversible technology. It creates irreversible health, environmental, and economic risks for the public. Thus, the cultivation of GM crops on a global scale inevitably leads to a sterile world, and the seed monopolies will increase the farmer's dependency and lead to bioserfdom on a global scale. What ought to, I'm speaking as a scientist, what ought to particularly concern scientists is that the companies effectively block research into less risky GM technologies because they want to recoup their investment. They have this unpredictable, potentially hazardous, probably very risky technology, but they invested their money in it. They want to get that money back. So therefore, they are effectively blocking science. They are the Luddites, not those who are opposing them. What are the choices for the future? Now, obviously, the choices are very stark. It is clear to many people that the unpredictability of this first generation of GM technology, the huge and ever-increasing chemical input, and the irreversible release of GM crops, combined with the GM companies' large financial and political power, will inevitably jeopardize our future. make no mistake about it, this will be it if you don't stop it. We must now definitely make our choice explicit for everyone. They must see that the only credible way forward is a low fossil fuel input agriculture, sustainable agriculture based on organic principles, and democracy and true science is the only way to sustain the world, its people. Thank you.
That was Dr. Arpad Pushtai. He was senior scientist at the Road Research Institute in Aberdeen, Scotland, until he was forced off his job, his computer seared, and his data confiscated. He had found health effects of genetically engineered potatoes in lab animals. Next up is Pat Roy Mooney. Born in Brandon, Manitoba, he has lived most of his life on the Canadian prairies. He wrote several books on the politics of biotechnology and biodiversity. In 1984, he co-founded RAFI, a small civil society organization addressing the impact of new technologies on rural communities. Pat Mooney spoke in the biotechnology section of the Teach-In on Technology and Globalization at Hunter College. However, as you will hear in a moment, he had already moved the agenda ahead to nanotechnology, the manipulation of all matter on the level of the atom. Pat Roy Mooney.
I'm going to try and throw out a series of challenges and questions for myself as much as for you of where we're going to go with some of these issues and if we're looking at the right dimensions of the issues themselves. I'm not entirely sure that we are. Sometimes I fear that in our focusing on biotechnology or even our more specific focusing on genetically modified crops, for example, that we have lost the sense of what's happening with other technologies. What else is going on out there? What's happening in space technologies? What's happening in robotics? What's happening with computer technologies or informatics that also affect and relate to what's happening in biotechnology? This is not a world in which there's simply one science functioning or one kind of technology operating. We start to see ourselves being linked up, as we've already heard, to machinery and seeing the kind of creatures we might someday become. We better be aware of what's happening in those other fields at the same time as we look at GM crops or even genomics. We've seen so far the first generation of genetically modified crops. Generation one was a generation which basically related to input traits, that the companies tried to convince consumers and the public at large that it would be a good idea if we all ate herbicide-tolerant crops. Not an easy sell. They lost. It was a bad technology, and it was also a bad marketing campaign. The second generation of genetically modified crops is going to be one which is really focusing on output technologies, technologies that are of interest to the food processors. They're already coming onto the market now. You've already heard about McGregor tomatoes, the so-called flavor saver tomato. It's a tomato that has a long lifespan. It'll actually live on the shelf longer than its patent will. This is not great food. That's sold for the food processors, and the processors themselves at this stage are convinced this is going to be a failure as well. Generation 2 will not work because, again, it provides nothing for the consumers. There's nothing there we want, and there's going to be no cost savings passed on to us as well, and they themselves acknowledge that. But then we come to Generation 3. Generation 3, which is not very far down the road, and we already hear about things like golden rice, the vitamin A enhanced rice and so on. These are the products which in fact are aimed at or said to be aimed at the consumer, that will somehow make you feel better, you can live longer, or at least if you die young, you'll look better. These kinds of sort of cosmo menus and so on that let you, in theory, live a better life in some way or another. Those are being developed. And when they do come along, they pose new challenges for us as activists as to how we address these. They're called nutraceuticals, and the nutraceuticals are, of course, the products which are grown in the field but do give us, in theory, this enhanced value of some kind or other. You know, the other term they use besides nutraceuticals is, in the advertising, is functional foods. What the hell was all the other stuff? I mean, think of it. These are companies, these are the food companies telling us they're now going to give us functional foods. After 100 years of processed foods, now they're going to be functional. I mean, right there you start to wonder about what they're saying to us and challenge them on that basis. There are also the so-called pharmaceuticals, and pharma is with an F. And these are where you grow the crop for multiple purposes. One part of the plant's used to provide a basically what's going to become a drug for somebody, and the other part of the plant is used for food for you. And God help you if you mix them up. There's jokes about how when you go to the grocery store in the future, you'll have to go and see the grocerologist before you can actually order something. You can get the wrong broccoli and you're in trouble and you're in the hospital. At a certain stage, when we get to Generation 3, the merger between food and health is complete, as it should be, in fact, in a normal world, but hasn't been for a very long time in industrial agriculture. And suddenly, the interest in terms of the corporate world is the possibility that they should also merge. We've already seen much of that, of course, in the past, but we'll see a new kind of merger. You can actually start to do betting games as to who will really win at the end of the day. Who will be on top of the heap in terms of the life industries? Will it be the food input companies? No. Will it be the output processors? No. Will it be the food retailers? Possibly. Or will it be, in fact, the pharmaceutical companies to control all of this? Because the different distinction between what is food and what is a drug product will be blurred completely and, in fact, marketed very much in the same kinds of ways. That changes the dynamics of industry considerably. And it also changes, then, what kinds of controls industry has to have in order to maintain its dominance in the marketplace. Myself and our organization and all of us here in this room, I think, probably share a common view that patenting of life is immoral and shouldn't be allowed. But the industry also sees that opposition growing. And for several reasons, they may change their strategies where patenting is much less relevant, where intellectual property rights, as we know it, is not as important as it is today. It may not become entirely useless, it may play a certain role, but let's face it, the reason you need to have intellectual property rights is to keep other people out of the marketplace. But if you have a highly integrated marketplace where there's only half a dozen companies anyways, then the need for intellectual property rights is reduced enormously. If you look at the biotechnology industry, what do you have? You've got the dominant patents. There's 1,370 dominant patents in agricultural biotechnology. 79% of those patents are held by six companies. That's all. And they're merging. So why do they need to have patents any longer? They're just talking to each other. And as they merge with the pharmaceutical industry and their patents, then the requirement for patenting in terms of keeping other people out of your market disappears. Secondly, of course, we're finding that patents don't work very well. The companies are very unhappy that they really can't trust either the patent examiner or the courts to give them the decisions that they want. And they can't trust the politicians not to reverse themselves as they see the patent rules changing in Europe and other places around the world. So they're finding patents to be an unreliable mechanism for monopoly. There are other choices. There are other strategies that they can use. Take, for example, the case of satellites. Satellite technologies are changing so rapidly, their capacity to monitor us and to monitor crops, for example, is just enormous. Today in Argentina, and also today in Australia, at least in the state of Tasmania, fields are being monitored by satellites, and they can identify the specific plant variety that's growing in the field. Motorola, together with some other companies, has developed now handheld machinery, which is able to go through a field, a farmer's bin, or a grocery store and identify DNA markers. They're now working with the satellite companies to see if they can attach that to the satellites so that they identify from space DNA markers in the field or in you. And if they can do that, then all they need is contract law to enforce their patent, and it's much safer, much more reliable, and patent system is no longer necessary. If we're not monitoring what's happening with satellite technologies and other informatics technologies, then we're going to miss the boat because we're going to be fighting about patent issues. At the same time, they've moved on to much more powerful systems of control. So we have to be following what's happening in satellites as much as they are. When we first started looking at these issues, we were talking about plant varieties, big chunks of DNA growing in a system. That's what we were concerned about. And with the movement of plant varieties, very quickly that went from plant varieties to a concern about specific genes. The technology kind of moved down, got smaller. Well, it's not small enough yet. It's going to get smaller still. It's going to get down to the level of nanotechnology, not biotechnology, nanotechnology. That means 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter. That means at the scale of atoms. As much as it seemed absurd, and Vinod and I were in a meeting back in 1987 where we tried to talk to everybody about biotechnology and tried to convince people in 1987 that biotechnology was important. And scientists and activists in 1987 couldn't believe us. They couldn't believe that life could actually be manipulated that way. You could actually move genes from one species to another. That couldn't really happen. It wouldn't really work. Great in the lab, but in theory, but in reality, it wouldn't happen. Well, I'd like to argue with you tonight that, in fact, as absurd as it may seem, it's possible to move one atom from one place to another. Is it possible to mix and match the elements? Is it possible to create new forms of atomic material? Is it possible to add to the table of elements? And it's possible even to patent the table of elements if you want it, or parts of it. And that in the ability to manipulate atoms, as we used to worry about manipulating genes, you've suddenly created technology which isn't just even a life technology, it is everything. It is what makes this thing. It is what makes this book. It is this. It is your food. It is every part of the industrial system. It's every part of everything we consume or wish to have, including ourselves. It is the peaceful use of the atom, one more time with feeling, and a new kind of and very powerful kind of control over all aspects of our existence. When you look at nanotechnology, when we began to look at nanotechnology, people were telling us that it was 25 to 50 years or longer down the road, if it happened at all. And again, the rule of thumb was it's too crazy, it's not going to really happen. That manipulation at the level of atoms just isn't going to happen. We looked at four measuring sticks to see whether or not really this was just lunatic science or really moving forward. Measuring stick one was, are scientists talking about it? Is it something that they are actually discussing among themselves? Well, back in 1989 or so, there were about 250 scientific citations in the literature related in that year related to nanotechnology. In 1999, there were about 4,000. And it's going up since then. We haven't tracked it as closely since 1999, but it's been going up by thousands every year. So it's probably this year, I'd guess, in the neighborhood of 7,000 or 8,000 references in the scientific literature. One indicator only. Second indicator is, well, is anyone patenting it? Do you see patents coming out into the market, you know, into the marketplace? Are people pursuing these things? Well, the first patents were granted in nanotechnology about 1988. One. In 1999, there were about 450 patents granted that year, and it's going up since then. There are a lot of patents out there. Now we're finding a few dozen every month. So it's growing again there. Third question was, or third indicator was, well, are governments spending money on this? Where's the critical mass of investment capital that's going into this technology? And the answer to that is yes. Clinton, a year ago, announced the National Nanotechnology Initiative in the United States, in Palo Alto, California, of course, and promised that the American government would double the investment in nanotechnology every year and described it as bigger than biotechnology. This year in the United States, the U.S. government is spending about $500 million in nanotechnology. That's compared to $100 million about 3 years ago. Next year it'll be $1 billion, and the year after that it'll be $2 billion. That's a fairly major investment in a very basic technology. The United States government believes that it's actually behind what's happening both in Japan and in the European Union. And they're right. There's probably a greater amount of investment in both of those areas than there is in the United States. So we have now an investment mass of probably in the range of $1.5 billion this year, going up to maybe double that again next year. So in terms of basic research into a new technology, this is as big as anything that's ever happened before in science. This is a major investment of government funds in these three areas of the world into this technology. You don't see that in any other field today. Then the fourth question is, well, who's actually doing the research? Are these dingbat scientists? Or are they actually people who've got some background behind them? Who are the ones who are the assignees for the patents? And that was what really finally convinced us that this is a technology that really is going to happen. Because if you look at who the major patent holders are, it's the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Army, Exxon, Boeing, 3M Corporation, Toshiba, Toyota, BASF, Bayer. It is every kind of company, by IBM, it is every kind of company in every industrial field you can imagine. and it's all the biggest companies, because we're talking about the building block of everything. And so they're all into the work. We also have, besides what we're calling the nano nabobs, we also have the nano niches, the small little boutique companies with all kinds of cute little names as well, and they're in the field. The difference between this technology and biotechnology is that with biotechnology back in the late 70s, early 80s, it was just the crackpot companies, just the little guys. Now we're finding it's the big companies and the little guys as well. The technology, which we thought was going to be 25 or 50 years down the road, will be with us within 3 to 5 years. If we don't organize now at the nanoscale and think in those terms, we're going to lose out desperately. I'm not suggesting we stop our work in biotechnology, but I think we have to add to that the added dimension of this going down, this declension in life. 30 years ago, I used to go around making speeches about biotechnology and biodiversity and saying that the Lord's Prayer, give us this daily bread, shouldn't be a prayer to Monsanto. But now, it's gone way beyond that. We shouldn't have to pray for our humanity to anybody. Not to BASF, not to Exxon, not to anybody. That should be ours. Thank you.
That was Pat Roy Mooney from RAFI, the Rural Advancement Fund International in Manitoba, Canada. Mooney received the Swedish Parliament's prestigious Right Livelihood Award and is widely regarded as an authority on agricultural biodiversity and biotechnology issues. Pat Mooney and Arpad Pushtai spoke at the teach-in on technology and globalization organized by the International Forum on Globalization at Hunter College in early 2001. I hope you have a pen handy for more information. You can find links to the websites of the organizations mentioned today on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get a copy of today's program with Arpad Pushtai and Pat Mooney for $12. That includes shipping. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gallardon. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.